Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Presenting Pixie Dust. I'm Elizabeth Carr.
And I'm Brett Harvey.
And we're back with our first return guest.
Yeah, yeah.
Mr. Ryan Smith, everyone.
Thank you very much. My very far away crowd.
So far away in our little studio here.
Ryan.
We're very excited to have you back on the show, Ryan. We're excited you wanted to come back.
First return guest.
First
it makes
return.
Me...
Yeah.
Think that I'm already superior to every other guest that's been on the show.
The only other guest. We've had two and you're the first return, so we're already doing better.
I got to say that I better talk to him like he's here.
Yeah, he's in the room with us.
Ryan is our first guest in the studio.
Yes, in our podcast studio. He's not recording from our bedroom anymore.
Yes.
He's not sitting on the bed.
Which is bittersweet, really.
Because where else would you rather be?
Just to point out for the listeners at home, the new studio is full of booze.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm staring at a cupboard, a shelf full of brown spirits
brown
liquor.
And liquor. I conducted a set of parent-teacher interviews via Zoom the other day.
Yeah.
And the liquor cabinet was in the background and I had to put a painting in front of it. So I had this nice painting in the background.
If I were you, I would have pointed it and said, this is your kid's fault.
If you'd like to add to it.
Some of those bottles are from parents.
Okay, so today is our second episode of our two-episode series for what we are now calling Mary Poppins March.
Yeah.
Because we are not the first podcast. Apparently great Disney minds think alike. Because we are one of three podcasts that all release Mary Poppins episodes in the last 2 weeks.
Really?
Yeah, so shout out to our friends at Cracking the Vault podcast and Ink and Paint podcast, who have all done Mary Poppins episodes.
There you go.
Recently. So Mary Poppins March it is.
Or the March of Mary Poppins.
No, I like Mary Poppins March better, because it's March.
Yeah, she did march around, though. You get my,
The good thing about when Mary Poppins marches is that she steps in time.
Yes.
She does.
And she doesn't need a reason.
Yes.
All right. She just
fits
steps
fat.
In time.
It's fun.
So we hope that you have tuned into our episode on Mary Poppins, which came out last week, episode number 36. If you haven't tuned in, you should go and do that before you listen to this one, because today we are diving into Saving Mr. Banks, which is the biopic made on the making of Mary Poppins.
And there's so many spoilers.
So many spoilers. If you haven't seen Mary Poppins, now is the time to go and watch it.
Yep.
Ryan, you wanted to come on and talk about this movie.
I love this film.
So do I.
Big time, mostly because I'm an Emma Thompson nut.
Mm.
She's probably my favourite actress. One of my favourite little tidbits about her is that last time I checked, at least, she's the only person to have won an Oscar for writing and an Oscar for acting.
That's amazing. What did she write?
She did Sense and Sensibility. Obviously not the original book.
I'm like, I think that was Jane Austen.
She did the screenplay. She's written a lot of things, though. She wrote the Nanny McPhee films as well.
That's
she
amazing.
Wrote Last Christmas, which came out last
year. She wrote
year?
Last
she
Christmas.
She wrote Last Christmas. Oh. It's funny.
Came
they
out
said,
last Christmas?
Well, you,
I
yes.
think the Christmas yeah. before. 2020, just nothing happened, so.
No, they went up to her and said, will you please write this, a film based on Last Christmas by George Michael? And she said,
go.
No. And then they said, here's some money. And she said, okay. But she's incredible. And you just see her. And, she was not nominated for an Oscar for this, which
she
is...
She should have been.
It's amazing, though, because
the
footage of Julia Roberts going up to her on the red carpet saying, I can't believe you got snubbed for this. She's got this beautiful email from Meryl Streep, who said, it should have been you, because she got nominated that year, because she's been nominated every year since 65.
Because she's Meryl.
Yeah.
She's Meryl Streep.
She was just incredible. And... Yeah.
You know, I read somewhere that Meryl Streep auditioned for this movie, that she auditioned for P.R. Travers.
I think she definitely auditioned.
I could see that. I could when you see the photos of P.R. Travers, the actual photos at the end of the movie, she does look a bit more
Meryl Streep.
Meryl Streepy.
I love
than
that.
Emma Thompson-y.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I love that they went with someone who was actually English.
Yeah.
I think that...
P.R. Travers would have approved of
yes.
that. Could you imagine if they'd gotten an American to play... Oh, my gosh, she would have come back.
That would have been a stab. That would be a stab yes. in the back.
That would have been the
end
of it.
And a writer, see. And the other thing is just this whole story with P.R. Travers is just heartbreaking, It's funny. You're looking at a darker side of Disney. And also the creation of this film, because the guy wrote it... It was on something called The Blacklist for a long time, which is people who write these incredible scripts that will never be made.
Mm-hmm.
And basically it was because he wrote it and went, oh, crap, with all of the Disney stuff in it, the only people who can produce it is Disney. And I think if I showed this script to Disney, they would send me a cease and desist.
Yeah.
So just never thought it was going to happen. And I do wonder...
That's actually got to do with one of my fun facts. Oh, well,
there we go. But yeah, I wonder though whether Disney, they gave him the script and Disney softened Walt from what was in the original draft.
I would say that definitely happened.
Yeah. And that, it's funny that, you know, Disney finally Disneyfied Disney, basically.
Yeah. They're Disneyfying history now. All right, so let's jump into some stats and then we'll get into some facts and then, because I don't think you'll stop talking, right?
No, if never. I told you I'll never stop talking.
You're on the clock, mate.
All right, so Saving Mr. Banks premiered at the London Film Festival on October 20th, 2013.
Yeah.
It has a running time of 125 minutes, which makes it nearly 20 minutes shorter than the actual Mary Poppins movie. Yeah. It has got a rating of 7.5 on IMDb and 79% on Rotten Tomatoes. So pretty consistent scores.
Yeah.
We've found with some of the movies, Ryan, that we've looked at. Mary Poppins actually was one of them that the like audience score, the IMDb score, differs greatly from the critical score. So Mary Poppins did very well critically and less so audience-wise, which was surprising.
Which is strange.
Yeah. I find it might be a bit of a tangent, but when I look at IMDb, like their list of their top 100, just that they might get a lot more male users than female users.
Oh, you reckon that's it?
Is
there a lot of Fast and the Furious stuff there or something?
A lot of that kind of stuff.
Disagree, because Mighty Ducks did not rate very highly on IMDb or Rotten Tomatoes, so you've got to take it all with a bit of a grain of salt. All right, fun fact number one.
Yeah.
On what you were saying, Ryan, about the development of this movie. So Essential Media Entertainment, which is an Australian production company, and BBC Films, which is, of course, a British company, initially developed Saving Mr. Banks as an independent production until 2011, when producer Alison Owen approached Walt Disney Pictures for permission to use copyrighted elements. The film's subject matter piqued Disney's interest, leading the studio to acquire the screenplay and produce the film.
Yeah.
So that's on that.
When did Walt pass?
66, I think. Yeah.
It's just, just sort of when you think about how he's obviously one of the central characters in this story.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if it would be made if he was alive, you know, whether that would have made a difference. Not that it could have ever been, because it hasn't been written so long ago, but, you know, I'm just sort of, it's just interesting that, Walt's gone. P.L. Travers is gone, and it's a sort of a retrospective thing of their, you know, and they've tried to match it so closely to their real, what actually happened.
More or less, with creative license.
Yeah, I think
you've got to have a little bit of creative license.
I think they
make
the story a lot nicer in some ways,
yeah.
Especially the ending, which maybe we'll talk about
when
we get to it, but I think they made it a lot nicer. And it's funny talking about the things with deaths, because, I don't know, I feel like... Maybe again, I'm going to get negative on Disney, but when P.L. Travers died, Disney went, yes, we're going to do the musical. We're going to do the sequel.
Yeah.
They just, and I just get this horrible image of these executives ringing her like once a year being like, are you okay? How's your heart doing?
Well, yeah, that was the case because they wanted to...
They'd have the representative on speed dial. Yeah.
When they were looking at doing the musical, she said Disney wasn't allowed to do it. She couldn't sign the rights to the musical over. She said they could do it, but Disney wasn't allowed to do it, and she wanted full creative control and everything. And then when she died, that was when Disney took it over and got involved. And
it's funny because I just think it parallels so well with what's happening with Disney as a company at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think everyone has their story now with either got a lot of Star Wars people who are like, what have they done to my Star Wars and Marvel people? And me, we're a smaller minority, but the Muppets as well. Like, I know it's hard because I'm sure there's a lot of non-disclosure agreements and stuff, but I know Frank Oz, who's the original Miss Piggy and Fozzie Bear, is pretty...
And Yoda.
And Yoda and Cookie Monster and Grover, and he's even in Monsters, Inc. But he's been pretty vocal that Disney's Muppets are not his Muppets, and it's quite... So it's interesting that they're sort of still going with this changing other people's property in a way.
Yeah.
It makes, it's just an interesting parallel to what's happening now.
But can I counter that and say that it's not other people's property, it's their property and they can do with it what they want. Now, I think when you, as heartbreaking as it is for people that love something so much, when you sign something over to someone, like P.L. Travers does eventually do in this movie, when you sign over your intellectual property, it's not your intellectual property anymore. It belongs to someone else and they can do with it what they like.
But this is where I get funny about this too, because I'm not a lawyer either, but I reckon you look at in the film, she says things like, no animation, no, and he doesn't. Maybe it's because those things, I haven't read the contract.
Yes,
but he's definitely, he's breaking verbal agreements here, there, and I'm going to be controversial and say Walt is the villain of this film, not Travers.
Well, is it a verbal contract if they're the only two people that hurt? Like, that's why you get everything in writing.
No witnesses, nothing in writing. That's why you need it in writing. Your handshake doesn't work. Yeah, look, you know, it's, I kind of see what you're saying there about Walt, but there is definitely some times where he really bullies his way through, and he does stuff anyway, knowing full well that she doesn't want him to do that.
That's why Walt is as successful as he is, because he doesn't take no for an answer. There were many times during his career when people said no to him, and he's like, don't think so, and he kept going. He said, you can't do that. Yeah,
like
I can.
The banks.
The banks said no a lot. We'll just find a different bank. And you know what? Look where the company is now. So,
and I think that's sort of the thing, the message I get from this movie too is that there are some compromises that need to be made. Walt made some compromises. P.L. Travers made some compromises to be able to get this movie to come through. And I think Walt ultimately convinces her. We're skipping these fun facts. But,
I'm like, let's wrap it up. We've got fun facts.
But like, to me, it's all about this, that he wants to bring this beautiful story to the audience that deserves it, the young kids, the people of the generation, and he convinces her that that's the way it should be. Even if there is some compromises being made both sides, if it's not made, then there's a huge audience that miss out on it. And I think that's sort of a Disney thing, is that they're very good at bringing these stories to life, and you know, because they know that it's good for people. The message is ultimately good for people. You know, it's good for the human spirit. That's what I get out of it.
So, fun fact number two.
Only on number two.
This is only the fourth film to have ever been shot within Disneyland. And it's the first film to actually have a star depicting Walt Disney as he roamed the paths of the happiest place on earth. Mm. One of the other films to have been shot in Disneyland just happens to be That Thing You Do, which was directed by Tom Hanks, who plays Walt Disney in this movie.
Yeah.
Right, fun fact number three, Richard Sherman served as a consultant on this film. At 85 years old, he is one of the only living people depicted in the film. So Richard Sherman's still alive. He's an old man, but he's still alive. So he's the
How
only...
How old would he be?
Oh.
90?
Oh. Yeah. Something like that. We can look it up.
Yeah.
He helped the cast and crew capture how the film Mary Poppins came to be, and he even taught Jason Schwartzman and BJ Novak how to properly play the music from the classic film on the piano. Can you imagine getting lessons from Richard Sherman on how to play Let's Go Fly a Kite? Oh. All right, so fun fact number four. The premiere was the first Travers had seen of the movie. And she did not initially receive an invitation, but had embarrassed a Disney executive into extending one. So in the film, we see her appear at Walt's office and demand that she goes, but it's not entirely historically accurate. She got a Disney executive to get her one, and it was a shock to her. Afterward, as Richard Sherman recalled, she tracked down Disney in the after party, which was held in a giant white tent in the parking lot adjoining their Chinese theater. Well, she said loudly, the first thing that has to go is the animation sequence. Disney looked at her and said coolly, Pamela, that ship has sailed. I love the idea of her after the movie's premiered going, okay, I've got some changes. changes we need to make.
I've got a critical review.
fun fact number five. The audio tapes of the working sessions between the real P.L. Travers and Walt Disney's team amounted to 39 hours, all of which screenwriter Kelly Marcel and later Tom Hanks and Damon Thompson had access. Thompson said she listened to all of them in preparation for her role, and that the experience was like being poked in the ear with hot forks. And you get a little bit of that at the end of the movie when you hear the tapes, and it's just not comfortable to listen to. It's so awkward going, oh, this woman.
It's like a headmistress telling kids off,
oh,
you know.
It's just awful. It's just awful.
I'm glad that they didn't put all of that.
All 39 minutes.
Yeah. In the.
It was just enough for you to get it and enough for you to go, okay, I've had enough of listening to that. Yeah. But wouldn't you love to listen to all of it?
No.
I think we got the best of it.
Yeah.
What I found from listening to it, actually, I think she sounds a bit more nicer in the original tapes than she does in the movie.
I think the exact opposite.
There's times in the tapes where she says please and things like that where we don't get that in the movie. She's very much more this will happen, doesn't actually say please to ask for anything. And, yeah, anyway.
It's, I don't know, for me, obviously I'm a big PL Travers sympathiser, we've got that. Yeah. The tapes to me, it's just clear they're just not listening to a word she says, and that kind of makes me, they're a bit like, uh-huh, yeah, okay, Pamela, stop talking. And I don't know, that makes me a bit sad, because again, I'm always going to be Mary Poppins belongs to PL Travers, come out of her head, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. All right, so fun fact number 6, PL Travers never did warm up to the song Let's Go Fly a Kite, as depicted in this movie. According to Richard Sherman, it was Feed the Birds that actually won her over.
Yeah. Well, it won over Walt as well,
didn't
it?
His favourite song.
Yeah.
Yeah, his favourite song.
Good song. Get out the tissue, honey.
Fun fact number 7, a map of Florida is visible in Walt's office with a mark on the planned location of Walt Disney World, which opened in 1971, which was 5 years after Walt Disney died.
There you go.
Yeah. And lucky last, so because I know Ryan's chomping at the bit, he's like, I've got more to say. We got one more, Ryan. We got one more. The production team was absolutely meticulous about every detail of Tom Hanks' portrayal of Walt Disney, right down to measuring the exact length of his mustache to make sure it was accurate with that of Mr. Disney himself.
Wow.
And those are my fun facts, Ryan. Go.
Yay!
I couldn't imagine anyone but Tom Hanks playing that role.
Oh, see, look, here's my thing on Tom Hanks.
Oh,
I love
know.
Tom Hanks. No,
you can't see anybody but Tom Hanks.
No, I love
that.
It's not seeing. It's not seeing because I love Tom Hanks so much.
Voice, okay,
but he's
right.
Got such a distinctive voice that whenever he talks, I just hear Tom Hanks.
But they both fit into that circle of wholesome, I suppose, which is definitely the way Disney wanted Walt to look.
Yeah.
So he's the perfect.
There's a lot
of
like
that.
The phrasing of his, you know, his phrases. Well, I think that was to me like. Something that I hung on to with that characterization.
Mm-hmm.
It was the ebb and flow of the way that he kind of, it was almost like molasses coming off his tongue, you know, the way he's trying to.
The Missouri of Mr. Disney.
Yeah, and he kind of, you know, he spends a lot of time trying to convince P.L. Travers of things. So there's this real kind of salesman and he doesn't get loud, he gets sort of quiet.
Yeah.
And he gets, you know, sort of. Suave a bit. There's a bit of that. Yeah.
And I love the name thing. They both just refuse to listen to it. He says, you got to call me Walt. And she's like, you're Mr. Disney. And she's like, you've got to call me Mrs. Travers. And he's like, you are Pamela. Unless they want something.
Yeah.
If they want something, they'll turn it on, which is funny. Even P.L. Travers, she struggles, though, because I think at one point she's like, I'm trying to get something from him, so I'll call him by his name. But she went with Walter.
Close enough.
Like, I can't bring myself to go with Walt.
I love the choice at the start of the movie to open with the 1964 Walt Disney Pictures Presents logo. I just thought that was, you know what the thing is with this movie, and I think it's why I love it so much, is there is such a beautiful sense of nostalgia throughout the whole thing that it's just magnificent. It feels like a hug when you're watching them put together this music and you're watching them, you know, seeing how it all plays out. And you know what's going to happen at the end. You know the movie's getting made. There's not a mystery to how the movie's going to finish because we know. But it's just, it's so beautiful listening to how it all comes together and hearing the songs that we know so well being played like it's the first time you're hearing them.
And seeing old Disney is kind of weird. Like seeing they've, even in the Disneyland sequence, they've somehow found these older looking mascot costumes and the merch.
The balloons. Somewhere.
The old balloons.
And all the Winnie the Pooh, and I love that too. Yeah. When she sees Winnie the Pooh and it's the same thing. She's like, A.A. Milne, what have they done? And the old looking Mickeys and things like that.
Yeah.
It's something really, odd about that.
Those are my two favourite scenes in the movie is when she... Obviously, the Disneyland scene, when I saw this movie at the cinemas in 2013, and when the scene comes where they pull up in the car And Ralph is like, it's him. And it's Walt Disney standing at the Disneyland entrance with the floral Mickey behind him. I went, oh, because it was just so perfect. Mm. It was just so perfect. And then I cried because it was so beautiful. So that's my favorite scene when they're at Disneyland. But my second favorite scene is when she arrives in LA and goes to the hotel. And the whole thing is filled with toys and balloons and everything. Like, this is my dream come true. And she's just like, ugh, I'm putting it all in the cupboard. And it's just, I just love that. I think it's so funny.
Yeah.
There's such an ego to it, you know, to these are all my creations.
Yeah, it is, yeah. Isn't it? It's which like, oh, no, what's your love?
Right off
me. Everything of me. Everything I have created, I'm going to put in this room with her.
Yeah, it's that sales pitch again. You yeah, know, exactly. This is how successful I am. Get on board.
But
yeah.
I think it's, I and think he's you're right.
He's not used to finding someone who doesn't revere him.
Yeah. And I think it's the ego thing, like you said, too. It's like, well, why wouldn't she want all of this? Of course she wants it. Everyone wants it.
Yeah.
You know, at this point, Disneyland had been open for nearly 10 years. It was a huge thing. Mm. And it was, you know,
he says that line at one point, everybody wants to go to Disneyland with Walt Disney himself. Yeah. Which is like, yeah, it doesn't appeal.
Just on Disneyland, the name itself, I read something or I watched something a while ago that they said when they were coming up with the idea for Disneyland, Walt wanted to call it Disneyland, and they were like, well, that's dumb. Nobody names a theme park after themselves, like Mickey Land or something, Disneyland. But because they had a television series before the park opened, it was like introducing the parks and, you know, the wonderful world of Disney. They said it so many times, Disneyland, Disneyland, but by the time it opened, it was just, oh, yeah, that's Disneyland. It's just what it's called. All the sort of cringiness of him saying, I'm Walt Disney and this is Disney. Can you imagine? My name's Ryan Smith and this is Smithland. Like, it's ridiculous.
There's only two people with the ego to do it, which is an awful comparison, but it's Walt Disney and it's Donald Trump. That's it. Oh, I'm going to stick my name on things.
Well, there's Dolly Parton too. Oh, Dolly Parton has Dolly Land, which I love. I love the idea of that.
Well, I want to change tack for a second. Okay. I'm acutely aware that some of our listeners, our audience, may not have seen this movie yet, and so I think it's important to frame it.
Good idea. So, we're half an hour in. Let's see this process.
So go with me on this. So the movie is set in two time periods. We've got, I'm using quotation fingers. Mm-hmm. It's set in the present,
which is 1961.
Yep, and that's where, you know, P.L. Travers, as an older adult, quite an older lady, she'd be 50s then, or maybe older than that?
She's probably exactly. just, yeah, late 50s. Yeah.
And she's, you know, been approached by Disney Company to, you know, produce this movie. And so it's all of the interaction between her and the Disney Company and Walt and the crew. But there's also this darker side, which is her childhood story. We get all these flashbacks, which are intermittent throughout the movie. And it takes us back to her being a little girl. What, about 6 years
1906,
old? 1906. No, but her age.
Oh, yeah, probably about 5 or 6, yeah.
Yeah, and it's 1906, Maryborough, Queensland.
Is where it starts.
Australia.
And they go to, but then they go to Ellora.
Mm.
Yeah, Australia. Well,
how do they say it? Ellora or Ellora? Ellora.
And, so we get this whole backstory. And we, you know, it's this big. I think it's really very clever how they weave it in, because each element of these flashbacks is relevant to something happening in the present. But we get this really sort of sad story about how her family, her dad, moves the family to Ellora. In the middle of nowhere is where the house is, in the middle of nowhere. It's a nice farmhouse.
Yeah.
But it's just her younger sister, the dad and the mum.
And baby, like a little sibling. I think
the mother's
sister.
Pregnant in the opening scenes, and then it's born and then, at some point.
And so then there's this journey where, you know, she has this big connection with her dad, more so than her mum.
Mm-hmm.
But then over time, dad starts to hit the booze and things don't go so well for the family. And that's when it gets really, really quite dark as we get into that. And so you've got this darkness of this backstory. And it's kind of almost in contrast with these. Oh, not quite in contrast. There's a lot of tension in the present scenes between Walt and the creative team and P.L. Travers. But what we discover throughout this movie is there's reasons why she's holding so tightly onto this Mary Poppins character and story. is because it's so interwoven with her own personal life.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't want to see that changed, brutalized.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Mm. So, framed.
Framed. I think that what it does very well, the flashbacks do very well, is that it makes P.R. Travers a sympathetic character. Because we see where she's coming from. If we didn't have those flashbacks, she is not as sympathetic. And I know you're a P.R. Travers sympathizer, Brian, but I think that without seeing her as a child and seeing those sort of throwbacks to different aspects of the Mary Poppins story, like her maid at her house in Maryborough's name is Katie Nanna, and her Aunt Ellie when she comes to visit and save the children from the father, you know, the father's just died from, you know, cirrhosis of the liver, and mum's got some postpartum depression or something's going on with her as well. And, you know, when her Aunt Ellie arrives, she's clearly Mary Poppins.
Yeah.
You know, she's got the carpet bag and she's got the umbrella and...
Umbrella with the bird.
With the bird on it. You know, she is Mary Poppins. And so you can see that this is where she's got... And that, you know, the horse's name is Albert and he's lost his ability to laugh. You know, it's got all these little references to the movie. And I don't know how factual any of that is, but it does make for beautiful storytelling
in
this movie.
Yeah, all those parallels, the little things. It's things like, you know, they're, when they're trying to come up with a name for Winifred and they list all of these names, and later on they're all the names Bert says during Jolly Holiday when he's like, this woman, this lady, and this lady. And it really didn't... I was surprised by this, but the part where she's tapping her toes to fly... Let's go fly a kite is exactly the same way Mary Poppins does it during Step in Time, which is a cool little parallel.
Yeah.
There's definitely the parallels between the backstory and the present, but then there's also little gems of, you know, things that were from real life as well.
Mm.
Or at least, you know, things that were represented in the original movie are now being re-represented in this story.
It's one of those pictures too where you just... It's, you know, to compare it to something non-Disney, it's like The Crown. You just want to know how much of it is true and how much... Because I know the story was a lot less pleasant, you know, because she never, ever came around to the film.
No.
And they definitely left it ambiguous, but she was just... She just didn't.
I don't think they left it ambiguous. I think they definitely made it look at the end of the movie like she was crying because she was so happy and relieved with how it had turned out.
Yeah.
And in reality, she didn't like the film at all.
And that's why she was crying, because she was... Yeah. That is on record. She cried through the premiere. Because she hated the film.
To me, in that last scene where she's watching at the premiere and she's getting upset, I don't know that it was so upset because she thought it was beautiful, but more because it triggered her.
Yeah.
That's the modern word for it, being triggered. All of the memories were coming back, all of these extremely sad, heartbreaking memories, and she's having to deal with it while watching a comedy movie. So,
it was just interesting too. Like, you know, I'm going to keep pushing this P.L. Travers supporter thing for a while, but I just could not understand how she went in and she said, no animation, no musical, and she just lost... No Dick Van Dyke. She just lost every battle.
Well, she was wrong about Dick Van Dyke. He's an angel in this movie, and that was a wrong choice if she didn't go with him, because he's magnificent. Absolutely magnificent.
Except he can't do a Cockney accent to save his life.
Doesn't need to. His accent's perfect. He is perfect. I will have no Dick Van Dyke slander on my show. Thank you very much. I'm going to get
kicked off in a minute. And then there's this interesting parallel too where, and again, it's making Walt sympathetic, where earlier on he talks about this somebody who wanted to buy Mickey Mouse, and he's like, and I couldn't do it. And it's funny because he still expects she's going to have to do it. You know, he's like, I couldn't do it, but I can get her to do it.
Yeah.
Something that really sort of grabbed me, the thing is, we all sit down, we know this movie, Mary Poppins. We know it's a Disney thing, and even still, they spend a significant time of the beginning of the movie not saying Walt Disney, or anything like that. They refer to him as he's expecting you, or this and that, but they don't say Disney and Walt. And I kind of really love that, because it's kind of, like I said, we already know who this damn movie's about.
I think
there's no escaping that, but yet we're still going to play this little storytelling game where we hold on to it until we reveal.
No, I think that it's just building this sort of sense of reverence of him, that they dare not speak his name. We all already know who you're talking about. I don't need to say Disney because you know who I'm talking about when I say him or the boss or whoever I'm talking about. You know, we know it's Disney. And then when we see him, it's just like, well, we hear him before we see him, which is really important, I think, to the to those people who are very familiar with Walt Disney's story, is that we know that he was a heavy smoker, would smoke 2 packs a day, and you would hear him in the corridors coughing, and that's how they knew he was coming. And before we see Walt, we hear him coughing. And I just thought that that was a beautiful touch. Because the movie is a Disney movie and a family movie, they weren't allowed to show. So Tom Hanks wanted to show Walt smoking, because that's what he did. Smoked all the time, but Disney wouldn't let him smoke on camera. So there's only one time where P.L. Travers bursts into his office and he's putting a cigarette out. That was his sort of compromise of, I'm going to put this out so that we know that he's a smoker. We do know that.
And you can just hear the next line is written by the censor saying, okay, you can do it, but make sure you say it's a filthy habit.
Yeah, that's right. I condemn this habit.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's made all the more sad with the fact that we know that Walt died 2 years later of lung cancer, directly related to, you know, his heavy smoking. And I actually, another time that I gasped
Can I say on that?
Yeah.
There was no tobacco warning at the
start. It said tobacco depictions.
Did it say what?
Yeah, it definitely did in the rating. It said, you know, PG or whatever it was.
Oh, wow.
Tobacco, mature themes, tobacco depictions.
There you go. Yeah. Because there's so many of those old Disney cartoons. Tobacco people depictions.
Smoking. So
those little kids smoking.
Pinocchio.
Peter Pan.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when we were doing, and Hunchback as well, because the goat smokes.
I was going to say Dumbo, but no, Dumbo just got drunk.
Yeah, Dumbo just gets high. He's not smoking. So when we did our Bambi episode a couple of weeks ago, we talked about how the animators would use the phrase "Man is in the forest" when Walt was walking down the corridor, and we actually hear Don DeGrady, who's the scriptwriter, hear him cough and go, "Man is in the forest," and you know they go to their places, and I just thought that was a really nice little touch. I just feel like so much care was taken with all of the details in this film. Whether you want to say that they're accurate to what actually happened or not, they've obviously done things very, very intentionally. There's no, you know, mistakes in this. Even when you go into Walt's office, which had to be recreated. So this wasn't shot at the same place where Walt Disney Studios were, because there is a person, a producer now, who is in Walt, who like owns and works out of Walt Disney's office. And can you imagine that? So this is Walt Disney's office and this is now my office. But he wouldn't let them film in there.
Yeah.
So they had to recreate it from pictures and stuff that they had of his office. And I just think it's so amazing. I love the idea that he's got all of his, you know, little trinkets and statues and pictures on the wall and everything. He's just like loving himself sick in there. And I just think it's awesome. I love it.
Well, that man is in the forest. It happened so quickly in the movie. So it's definitely been put in there for the fans, because I think a normal audience member wouldn't even realize it was a thing.
Well, you didn't hear it. I went, oh my God. And you went, what? And I said, rewind it. Come on, play it again.
Yeah.
And we heard it the second time. The because it happens really, really quick.
Yeah.
Funny thing too with this film, and it's a personal one, but it's funny how you watch something, say, 5 or 6 years ago, and then you watch lots of other stuff that the actors are in, and then come back and you're like, I know all of these people. And I didn't recognize them. You know, BJ Novak is one of the Sherman brothers who's in The Office. So it's like, oh, Ryan is here. Don is played by Bradley Whitford, who's Josh Lyman in The West Wing, which I watched too. And I didn't even realize, stupidly, Aussies represent. Rachel Griffiths is
Aunt Ellie. Yeah.
The Mary Poppins kind of stand-in. Mm-hmm. You just look at her and you go, oh, wow.
Hello.
I did not know this was you. Yeah.
Can we talk about how good-looking Colin Farrell is in this movie?
Even on his deathbed.
Oh, even on his deathbed. Even when he's jaundiced, it's like, oh my gosh, goodness me. I'd follow him to Allura as well.
You're like, wipe the blood off, I'll still make out with you.
Sure, let's go. Walk me through the bush, let's do it.
Yeah, ride me on the horse. Saddle, well, without a saddle, horseback.
He's interesting too, because his character, and the same as P.L. Travers, they're this weird mesh of kind of sad and broken, and but there's a whimsy there too. Because P.L. Travers, you don't see it as much, and then my favourite scene in this film is where she's just after she stormed out, and she's sitting in the grass, and she's building a moat with Ralph.
And the fairy house.
Pretty. It's just so, she's like whimsical, but she, because she has to be to write that book too, but she's really serious about her whimsy. Like,
she takes her whimsy very seriously.
Oh, a river. And she goes, it's a lake. Goes, oh, sorry, a lake. And every scene, with Ralph just makes you cry.
Oh, he's just beautiful, just a
gorgeous
he?
Character. Oh,
Gordie Manny.
Yeah.
Yeah, now let's stop and talk about him for a second.
Yes, so he's...
Big fan. He's been in a lot of big films. Yeah.
I feel like Paul Giamatti's just in a lot of things.
Yeah.
And it's not until you're watching, you're like, oh, that's him.
I don't know. I know he's in a lot of things,
and I'm trying to name one, and I'm coming up empty.
What was that one where he was in the singing one? Gwyneth Paltrow, singing, I don't know.
I don't know what you're talking about.
God.
I do know.
Somebody duets help out. Or something.
Duets, is that it? Yeah.
Maybe.
I do know that he was in a movie with Amanda Bynes and Frankie Muniz called Big Fat Liar, where they turn him blue to the tune, I'm blue. He's like a film producer and they get him good. It's like a hijinks comedy. I love that movie when I was a kid.
I think you're right, though. He's one of those actors where, it's hard to pick what movies he's been in. Because he's not been a leading man as such. He's usually that
secondary character.
Yeah. But G does a good job in this.
He's gorgeous.
Because, there's not a whole lot of lines.
No.
But there's just something that's really lovable about him.
Yeah.
You know, in the way that he treats Mrs. Travers with such a kind heart. Which, he's a limo driver.
Yeah.
So he's probably used to just picking people up and dropping them off and not having anything to do with them.
Yeah.
And, there he is making friends with the strange lady.
He's probably also used to people being happy to speak to him. Yeah. Because if you're a limo driver in LA, you're usually picking up people who are excited to be there, not someone who is going like, oh, God, this Disney character, now I'm going to have to go to Walt Disney Studios. He's like, are you for real? Like, yes, this is exciting.
You get to go there.
That's one of my favourite lines when she sits down on the plane and she just says, I hope we crash.
Do you know what my favourite P.L. Travers moment in this movie is, or one of them, is when she's it's like really early and they're working out, they're looking at the Banks household and they're showing them the mock-ups of the characters, and they're talking about why they've made Mrs. Banks a suffragette and that she needed a job outside of the house because why else would they get a nanny? And she goes, are you calling Mrs. Banks neglectful? And BJ Navarro goes, yep. And then she kicks him out. And she's like, you can wait outside. And then off he goes, off he leaps off and stands outside the door. And I just thought that was so funny.
And the best line after that, she goes, why is he limping? He was shot. And she goes, I'm not surprised.
Oh, that's so funny.
She's just got no social grace.
When they're singing the song, the opening song, and they say, responsible, and she goes, that's not a word. Oh, we made it up. We'll unmake it. And then you see them hiding the supercalifragilistic music underneath that. Like, we're not showing her that today.
Because it's funny.
This is not the moment.
Yeah. There are moments where they suggest she's genuine in a lot of her complaints. And in a lot of them, but then there are some where she gets to a point where she's like, I've had enough. I'm going to tank this.
Yeah.
Like, no red in the film. That's her way of going,
I've just gone off it. That's all I am.
But I reckon that was her way of going, you can't make this film. I'm going to do everything I can to just tank this project.
You're
ruining it. And that's the other scene I love where she tells them off for the way they present Mr. Banks.
Mm-hmm.
When she says, he was not a monster, and she asked them about their kids. And like, would you rip up their letter and would you not mend their kite? And she just has this breakdown, and that's where she should have at least got an Oscar nomination. It was just perfect. Yeah. It wasn't overdone. It was just...
Yeah. And then we flash to why she's so adamant that he's not going to have a mustache, because we see her father saying, would you rather scratchy kisses or smooth kisses? And it's just one of those beautiful moments of, because she's got a reason. She's not sharing because she doesn't want to be vulnerable with these people and explain. Or maybe she doesn't even fully understand why she's so set on these things, but as viewers, we're watching it, putting all the pieces together. Why she throws the pears out of the window in the first one of the first scenes we see her into the pool. She's like, no pears, and she's throwing them out, and then we find out later that that was when her father died, was when she was off getting pears because he asked for them.
Mm.
And she didn't get to say goodbye to him in that moment. And so all of these little elements start to come together to put together this very fully formed character that we're only seeing half of in the Disney studios.
And it's funny thinking about her version of Mary Poppins versus Julie Andrews' version of Mary Poppins. And I've been thinking about this all
day. Have you read the Mary Poppins books?
I've read a few of them.
Okay, so you are a long time ago. You are a better expert on this than we are, because we haven't read them.
Basically, her version is darker and more mysterious. What I think is really cool is if I were to pick a parallel, it would be Nanny McPhee, which was written by Emma Thompson. But she's sort of more about teaching the children, and she's a bit dark and mysterious and a bit stern. And what I think is interesting is now that P.L. Travers has passed away, Disney are starting to produce that Mary Poppins in a way. In the Broadway musical, it's a lot closer to the books. Part of that is because P.L. Travers says a bloody well better be. But also Emily Blunt's Mary Poppins is a lot more closer to the one in the books, which I think is really interesting. But it also makes me think. She's just sterner.
Yeah.
She's sterner. She's a bit more mysterious. She's a lot less...
Is she older?
The only word
in the
I can think of is Disney.
She's older a lot less in the princesses. Books.
She's a little bit older
than Julie Andrews was.
But she's beautiful. And I think that's maybe where Disney went, cherry cheeks and, spoonful of sugar and bright. Mm-hmm. Whereas this one is a lot more mysterious, Nanny McPhee-ish, mysterious and darker. Yeah. And it also makes me think that maybe her Mary Poppins was a bit ahead of its time. Like, a 60s audience weren't ready for a character like that, whereas 2000s, were a bit more attracted to darker characters.
I kind of would think that, what I know of movies, of the past, is that women tended to take a bit more of a softer role. It was always the men doing the hard things and being, in charge and all of this sort of stuff. So to have a female lead as the, the strict, like you said, headmistress kind of character, probably would have been very ahead of its time.
And if they best, especially in the 60s and 70s and whatever, when female characters bested male characters, it had to be through trickery and the men didn't really know. Going probably a little bit off tangent, but in Mary Poppins, she bests Mr. Banks a few times, but it's because she bamboozles him rather than wins an argument. She just kind of tricks him and confuses him, which is very Mary Poppins. But again, that's just the only way they could win back then.
Yeah, absolutely. I loved every scene that they had where they were writing a song or brainstorming, putting together a song. The scene where they're writing Spoonful of Sugar and they have the breakthrough that they need to go... Breakthrough. Where they need to go up instead of down, and it changes the whole vibe of the song, is just amazing. And listening to them, write Let's Go Fly a Kite and then dancing to it and go that scene where Walt walks in on Richard playing Feed the Birds on the piano and he just sort of stands with him until he finishes, goes, yeah, that'll work. And I just went, yep, that's beautiful. I just loved every scene where they played the music. So you just forget how much we love these songs and that somebody wrote them. They didn't just appear out of nowhere. This was someone's work to write these songs that now everybody knows.
Yep.
Everybody knows, and it's just
paper and a pencil and a piano.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's just amazing. Just geniuses. I do wonder how long they had to shut... I do wonder how long they had to shut Disneyland to film in there.
Yeah.
I read it somewhere, but I can't remember.
Was it a long time?
They never shut the whole park.
Oh, was it just Main Street?
Main Street, the castle, and... Fantasyland, and I think they were very much, you have to do this quickly.
Yeah.
So,
I think it was only like 2 or 3 days, but they never shut the whole park.
Yeah. Which is amazing when Disney's producing it and Disney owns the park. You think that they could just do whatever they want.
Do you know how much money Disneyland would make
Disneyland
in a day?
Is where, it's where all of their cash really comes from, percentage-wise.
So
might have been the most expensive part of the film.
That's my first tangent. My second tangent is that at one point she does say that she has no family when she's talking to Ralph.
Mm.
Says, don't you have family? And she says, well, no, not really. And before in this, at the start of the movie, they ask her if she has children, and she says, well, no, not in a manner of speaking or whatever. So P.L. Travers had a kid. She had a son that she adopted that was actually a twin, and she just took one of them and left the other one. Yeah, and the twins found each other later in life, and then she became estranged from her son because she didn't tell him that he was a twin. Like, she didn't even know he was adopted. He just thought that this was his mum. So she adopted him when she was in her, when she was 40. So she was quite, you know, she was an older mum. And she adopted this kid. But they make no mention of a child at all during this film.
It's probably just a plot element that just overcomplicates, you know what I mean? So especially if they're estranged, because she doesn't really ever say, I don't have it. Well, I suppose she did at that one point.
She didn't say, I don't. Yeah. Do you have children? And she says, no, not in a manner of speaking.
Yeah.
So she doesn't say, no, I do not. She.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So to me, one of the things I was going to bring up, my tangent, it's kind of related, is that there's very strict, like with the storytelling, you know, way that they run this particular movie, is that we've got that very much a present and very much that young girl past and none of that sort of in between stuff. So there's obviously there's decades and decades and decades between that childhood and the present, which would have formed, because she moved to England. It would have formed a huge part of that Mary Poppins character, is all of that English characterization, you know, that sort of that the English way of life, which she sort of spoke about, mentioned in this film. It's about being English. And I just think that's really interesting that they didn't really include anything from that in-between period. And I think, well, it probably would have complicated things too much. And also, it kind of plays better, I think, that the influence of her current decisions hark right back to when she was a child. Probably doesn't matter the stuff that was in between. But it was just all that stuff from... And it's, you know, it's kind of a commentary on how that early childhood trauma affects people right through their life. And they may not ever get over these things. You know, that to me, that's one of the subtle commentaries that happens in this movie, which I really like.
And it's funny, I always think films with two stories, and I don't know why this always bewilders me, but it just makes me think Colin Farrell and Emma Thompson did a film together and probably never met. Those storylines never crossed. And it's just... I don't know why that bewilders me, but it's just how you can make a piece of art with someone and just not meet them.
And not meet them, I think that the part of this movie that got me really angry on behalf of P.L. Travers, it's like one of the few points, because, you know, I'm a Walt Disney stan forever, but one of the points where I thought, geez, this man is manipulative, because I don't think her request that there was going to be no animation in this movie was unreasonable. And right from the start, they said, no, no animation, no animation. So the scene where she says to the Sherman brothers and Don DeGrady, oh, so how are you training the penguins? How are they going to dance? Like, you're training real penguins to dance? And then Richard Sherman says, no, they're animated. And you see her face, because this is after Let's Go Fly a Kite. She's on board. Yeah. You know, she's had that turning point of, I think this is going to be okay. Mm. And then to see on her face, you see the moment that it all just comes crashing down and those walls slam back up and she's like, nah, we're not doing this. And she storms into Walt and she says, you lied. You're a liar. I don't trust you anymore. And he just, you know, he's told her that there was going to be no animation. That was the deal the whole way through. And it was live action. Nope. Pamela's live action movie. And then to find out that, yeah, they had lied to her because they knew the whole time that they were going to add this in. And they were just waiting for her to sign the papers to just be like, oh, well, it doesn't matter now. We've got it. And that part was just really like, that's not fair.
And to add to that, like, we recognised when we reviewed Mary Poppins the movie,
the animation wasn't even good.
in the last episode, we both totally agreed that animation sequence was way too long, largely unnecessary.
Yeah.
The only really good part of it was the dancing with penguins. Dick. Just to clarify, Dick Van Dyke. But that, you know, they could have cut all of that out. That would have been like 10, I don't know what it was, but like 10, It was upwards of 10 minutes, maybe closer to 15 of this animation that did not need to be there.
P.L. Travers was right.
And I reckon, you know, like, if they had just done the penguins, you know...
But that wasn't the point. The point was they said no. Yeah. They said we're not going to do it. And they knew the whole time that they were. And that's not cool.
That drove me nuts.
That was the moment I was like, oh, like,
that's just
you knew.
Disney being ruthless. So, like you said, he's a businessman at heart. Like, there's a go-getter about him. He's going to make it happen. You know, maybe he's just used to stepping on people along the way to do it.
I assume back in the 60s, too, it was sort of a new technology to be able to combine... he just really wanted to showcase it off.
Yeah. And he had a few movies where that happened, like Pete's Dragon and...
Bedknobs and Broomsticks.
Yeah, there's a few of them.
Again, with a long, unnecessary
animation sequence. But, I mean, I think the thing, because this is a Disney movie, and obviously Walt has got... listen to me first naming him again. Walt, my mate Walt, got this, you know, not reputation, but this side of him that, you know, built the happiest place on earth, created Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse and Goofy and Donald Duck and all these characters that we love so much and has such a special part in a lot of people's lives with creating these movies that are so heartfelt. But there's plenty of evidence to suggest that there was another side to his personality that was really ruthless and really... You know, we'll get what
selfish.
He wants.
Which is an interesting thing about this film being produced by Disney, because I think you keep talking about it being authentic, and in a lot of ways it was in the detail, but I also think they've very deliberately gone, we don't show those bits.
Yeah.
We show a lot of Pamela being a bit crazy and overbearing and Walt being bewildered, but we don't show the parts where he can be a bit nasty in the way that he does this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I did like the scene when, the scene with Ralph when she's leaving after she, you know, has her big spat with Disney and she's leaving and she gives him the book and, you know, it's a book of, she says a book of people with difficulties, referring to, you know, his daughter, because he mentions earlier that she's handicapped, his words, not mine, but that, you know, she's handicapped and she's in a wheelchair and, you know, she says she can do whatever she wants to do. So I'm going to cry because it was such a beautiful scene. And then, you know, on the back it has, he goes, Walt Disney, and she just goes, hyperactivity disorder. It explains everything.
And I love how even when that's probably the kindest she gets but she's still her. Like, I love, she says, Ralph, you're the only American I've ever met that I've liked. And he says, can I ask why? And she says, no.
No. But then you have that beautiful scene at the end when she's going to the premiere and she says, call me a cab, and Ralph comes to pick her up. And then as she gets out of the car and he's like, don't forget, this is all because of you. And I'm going to cry again, but I'm just pushing through. And then as she starts walking, you know, she grabs his arm and squeezes his arm like, okay, we're here together. Like, thank you for this. As she walks up. But then that's such a heartbreaking scene too, because, you know, the Sherman brothers are being interviewed and Walt's being exalted over on this podium over here with his wife and Julie Andrews, who, funnily enough, never gets mentioned throughout this whole movie. They talk about Dick Van Dyke. Julie Andrews' name is never mentioned at all. But
she was fairly unknown when she did
when she did Mary Poppins.
At least in film circles.
She, as she's walking up the red carpet, you know, no one even acknowledges her. No one knows who she is. No one knows why she's there. Like, she's walking up alone, which is, you know, when she turns around and Mickey's offering his arm to her and walks her up the red carpet. It's such a lovely moment. And then they sit her, for some reason, framing, you said, as we were watching, they sit her in between the Sherman brothers. Do you think that she put herself in that seat that she saw Richard sitting there, went, I'll just sit next to you. She's like, actually, this is Bob's. No, I'm sitting here. And then Bob came up and was, okay, looks like she's sitting there. That's fine. I'll sit here.
Wanted to sit in front of Walt so that he would know exactly what's
going on. I'm here. You didn't want me here, but here I am.
It's funny, that red carpet moment. It's like you said, it's, you know, her film, but yet she's surrounded by his creations too. Yeah. The penguins are there. The only thing from Mary Poppins that are there that she doesn't like, and it's Mickey and, you know,
Snow White.
But she was never meant to be there, as the story goes. Yes. You know, so it was never about her.
No,
that's the sad part. It was never meant to include her and highlight her as the foundation of this idea.
Yeah, it does say in the opening credits, it does say based on the book by P.R. Travers, but it's much smaller than all the other fonts.
Disney.
Yeah. Much smaller than everything else. I thought that her reactions watching the movie were really great. You could see her like rolling her eyes or shuddering when she didn't like things.
Yeah.
And then of course she starts just sobbing during the movie, which I think, yeah, is meant to show in this movie that she is, you know, moved, or, you know, she understands and she's feeling, you know, really emotional about it.
Mm.
But in reality, she was crying because she hated it. And they said that Walt, some of my research, they said that Walt was really angry at her because she made such a spectacle of crying in the movie, and it wasn't at a sad bit. It was, she was just crying, that he was like,
yeah,
quite annoyed at her for making such a scene.
Yeah.
The credit photos and the voice recordings at the end during the credits, they are another one of my favourite bits, because I just love seeing, when they do a biopic, I love seeing the photos of the real people. Mm. And that's like my favourite bit of saying, oh, this really did happen. And, you know, you see Walt and P.L. Travers, and you see the Sherman Brothers, and see Julie Andrews with Walt Disney at the premiere. And I just thought that was really nice.
Mm.
And then the recordings are awful and wonderful simultaneously. And I think I was saying to you guys as we were watching it, because Ryan watched the last 15 minutes with us because we hadn't watched it yet. But as we were watching that, I said, what a beautiful, amazing thing to have on record is still have these recordings that you can refer back to, these original recordings from 1961. That's all I
still don't
want
to listen to.
Not all of it, not all 39 hours. All right, so how many animated penguins do you give this movie, Ryan? Out of 10.
Out of 10.
How many penguins?
I love this film. I can categorically say I love this film, but I'm going to give it a 7.
Okay.
Just again, because like I said, I think they Disneyfied Disney and they made it. I think they sort of presented an argument and went really one-sided with it of she's crazy and he's wonderful. And I can't help, and I'm going to keep saying, I can't help to see what the original script would have looked like or what the film would have looked like.
When it was an independent film?
If it was made by someone else.
Yeah,
I'm
the BBC.
I'm really curious to see what the BBC would have done with it and what he would have looked like. I don't think, I'm not saying they would have made her look saying, I've heard the recordings. But I just think they might have leveled it up a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm going to say 7 for that.
There you go.
And I love Disney, but it's funny that it's this, all my friends I know who don't like Disney and roll their eyes at it, I felt myself doing it a little bit in this film. You know what I mean? I love Disney, but I'm not. It's probably the wrong forum to say this, but I'm not in the cult.
We are open to all members.
We will indoctrinate you.
We are accepting. I mean, we're the first ones to say that Disney is not without its faults, and it's definitely made some mistakes throughout the years.
How many bird umbrellas?
I'm going to give it an 8. I really loved the, like I said at the start, the sense of nostalgia in this. I loved watching all like old school Disney. I don't care how accurate it is or isn't. I thought it was really beautiful. I felt like I've seen this movie a few times and in the more recent times, not this last time when we watched it for this, but in the more recent times, it's horrible and I really feel bad for saying it. But when it's like the flashback scenes, I fast forward through them because I just want to watch the Disney scenes, the scenes where she's at the studio and when we're at Disneyland. So I think that it's really great. And I think that all the actors do a spectacular job in every role that they're in. And I didn't mention it when we were talking about the movie, but one of my favourite scenes as well is that when we cross to P.L. Travers back in London, back in her house, and the giant Mickey Mouse that was on her bed is sitting at her kitchen table. I just thought, because she's obviously taken it with her. So she has sort of drank the Kool-Aid a little bit, that she's taken this home. This very, very big Mickey Mouse has obviously meant something to her throughout the whole time, even though she did put it in the corner facing the wall when she first got in there. But then, you know, it's at her kitchen table, so she must have taken it home.
Mm.
I think she was
planning to stick pins in it.
Like a voodoo doll.
Then take one of the 15 small ones that he sent you, not the big one. But no, I'm going to go an 8 out of 10.
An 8, okay. Cool.
How many vintage...
No, hang on. Ryan's going to do me.
Okay, go on, Ryan.
Yeah, you did Ryan. I did you. Ryan's going to do me.
Okay.
All right.
How many pairs would you fling out a window for this film?
A whole bunch. Look, I'm up there with an 8 to 8.5
Oh,
pairs.
Loves a half.
I do like a half.
He loves to fake sit. You can't do 8 or 9 steps.
I think this movie's got a lot of heart. Mm-hmm. I think that it investigates some subject matter which is really tricky, and unlike Disney to invest time dealing with such depths of subjects as grief and trauma, childhood trauma, especially when it comes to the father being an alcoholic and that's the contributes to his demise. The mum's tries to kill herself. Mm. Spoilers, we did say spoilers, didn't we?
It's a bit late for that.
But, I don't know of many other Disney movies that do that. And they do it with such care, and I think they do it with respect. There's a lot of humour in this movie as well to kind of offset that, and I love the to and fro that's created between Walt and P.L. Travers. You know, whether it follows history exactly is another question, but the delivery of the movie, I think, is exceptional. And those names we've mentioned, the actors, are just at the top of their game, mm-hmm. and whatever they touch is gold, and I think this one's gold. Oh. 8.5
pairs.
Out
the window.
Out the window.
Into the pool. All right. So is there anything else you want to say, Ryan, before we finish up?
Not really. Not nothing that's good to end on, I suppose. Just stuff I wish I'd said earlier.
Go on, you can say it now.
No, I don't know. I will say one other thing that bothers me a little bit about this film, and this may be me being too PC, and again, it's representative of the times. There are times where I look at it and I go, oh, it's four men rolling their eyes at the hysterical woman.
Yeah.
And I just go, oh, that doesn't sit well with me. Mm-hmm. Would have been representative of what was happening in the 60s, but yeah. Ultimately, it's just Emma Thompson. I'm still, however many years later, is it 6, 4? I don't know. Really angry she didn't get a nomination.
2013, so it's like
so
it's
7, yeah. 8 years ago. What day is this? Where am I?
Where are we?
Who are you?
But
well,
I just think
it's really only 7 because 2020 didn't count.
No.
She said this is her most difficult performance, and I just think she deserved more. I think she got a lot of other nominations, but I just think she deserved the nod.
Shall we make her an honorary Oscar?
Yes.
I can just see you like out the front of like the Oscars, yeah. Academy Awards.
Picketing.
P.L. Travers. Emma.
Justice for Emma.
And a story I cannot believe we touched on, which just explains my love for Emma Thompson so well and what she's like. It was during the Let's Go.
Yeah.
Let's Go Fly a Kite scene. And they were rehearsing it, and it wasn't quite working, and the room was getting really tense, and they'd had enough. So finally she was looking Bradley Whitford in the eye while he's doing his scene, and she just whips open her top and flashes him with 2 Mickey Mouse pasties on her breast. And it's just, if you ever see Emma Thompson in an interview, she's flashing
with air,
but she's just so funny.
Yeah, she is funny.
Yeah.
She's great.
Brilliant.
Yeah, let us go fly a kite.
Let us go and fly a kite. Let us go that one. Yeah.
Let us go and fly a kite.
You can't mind on that one. That's fine. I loved it. I thought that it was so good.
Mm.
All right, Ryan, do you want to pimp yourself out? Where can our wonderful listeners find you?
Where can you find me at the moment? The best place to find me at the moment is probably on my Instagram, which is just 1993 Ryan Smith. But again, that's only if you want to see pictures of my socks. I don't put a lot on there. But I do have a couple
of... Or your social media scam for
you. Yeah, all my fun with social media scammers. I have got a couple of shows coming up with my theatre group, which is called Pick Last for Sport. You can look us up on Facebook. We've got some things coming up, which I'm not allowed to talk about just yet, so I'm going to shut up.
That's all right,
never mind. But look us up, because there'll be announcements coming soon.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining us for another episode. We love when you come in and talk to us. Ryan will hopefully be back later in the year with another couple of episodes if he will have us back. He's happy to come sit in the studio and not in the bedroom. Not sitting on the bed for this episode. Thank you so much, gorgeous listeners, for tuning in. If you're feeling really generous, you can go and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts because it really helps people find the show. You can also follow us on Facebook and Instagram, and you can check out Brett's other podcast if you're a teacher or a teacher sympathiser, called Teaching for Dummies, yeah. And that is also wherever you find your podcast.
Yeah.
Did you want to say anything else, Brett?
Oh, big shout out to Cara, who I found out last night is a big fan of the show.
Oh, hi, Cara. Thanks for tuning in. We love you.
Good on you, mate.
All right. Well, we will see you all next week with another episode, or maybe in 2 weeks, depending on how busy we are. All right. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.